Species.
Unite.
Species.
Unite.
It's almost like the Animal Welfare Act is like a security blanket, because it's like, oh, we have the Animal Welfare Act to protect the animals. Like, they're okay. And they don't realize right. that it's actually not very strong and that it's not being very aggressively enforced.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We'd like to thank Lush for sponsoring today's episode. Lush advocates for people, animals, and the planet. Through their ethically sourced ingredients and their grants program, they give back locally and around the world. In February, Eric Kleinman from the Animal Welfare Institute was on the podcast. He came on to talk about the Envigo dogs, the 4,000 beagles that were rescued in Virginia last summer. They were at a breeding facility for research animals, and to talk about trafficked monkeys and the failures of the USDA to enforce the Animal Welfare Act. Before Eric and I met, he sent me a ton of articles on much of the above, and many of them were National Geographic stories written by Rachel Fobar. Rachel Fobar is a National Geographic reporter who covers wildlife crime and exploitation. So I asked Rachel to come on the show because I want to better understand why is it that we are allowing the USDA, who almost never does their job, to be in charge of the Animal Welfare Act. Rachel, thank you so much. It's awesome to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Will you just explain what it is you do and what you report on?
Sure, yeah. So I'm a reporter for Nat Geo's Wildlife Watch team, which is an investigative unit that focuses on wildlife crime and exploitation. I didn't go into journalism knowing I wanted to cover animals. I actually started off covering criminal justice and potentially wrongful convictions.
You write wildlife crime and exploitation,
right.
But a lot of animals that you wouldn't really think of are covered under that.
Like, oh, yeah.
When I hear wildlife crime and exploitation, I'm like, oh, poachers. You cover so much. There's 92 different things you've written incredible stories on.
Thank you. So. Something my team likes to say is that if any animal you can think of is poached or exploited in some way, like I have a colleague who wrote about leech trafficking.
And we're doing bad things to animals. Like, you can't really throw a rock without like a bad story.
Exactly. Right?
There's a couple of things I want to focus on. One is the Envigo dogs and research. The other is roadside zoos, which seem very separate. But the reason I wanted to cover both is because both of them, one of the biggest culprits in a lot of what's going wrong is the USDA. I don't even understand why the USDA is in charge of all this stuff. Like, it just doesn't even make sense. So maybe we could start there. Why is the USDA running the show?
There's a department within the USDA that enforces the Animal Welfare Act. And it's funny that you mention why do they even enforce the Animal Welfare Act, because for a story I did a year or two ago, I was looking up when Congress actually introduced the Animal Welfare Act. And there was a whole conversation where it was like, okay, we have this act. Who's going to enforce it?
When was this?
It was in the 1960s.
Okay.
I have to look up the exact year, but 1960s. They were basically just like, well, we should have the USDA do it since they're already covering agriculture and, you know, farmed animals. The head of the USDA at the time was like, no, we shouldn't do it. We don't want it. And then they got stuck with it anyway. So that's who enforces our Animal Welfare Act.
Well, it actually makes sense. The way they've done their job pertaining to this stuff, kind of the whole way through, is like someone who doesn't want that job.
It's a huge job. I mean, there's so, like you already know, there's so many roadside zoos and labs around the country that need, you know, animal welfare enforcement.
They are in charge of Animal Welfare Act for animals anywhere in captivity.
In captivity and any animals that are on display. Basically, if you profit off of animals, you need to be inspected by the USDA.
Yes, it's a big job, but it wouldn't seem to be such a hard job considering the Animal Welfare Act.
It's a very vaguely worded text. It leaves a lot of wiggle room for inspectors to interpret. And then, of course, there are some USDA inspectors who care a lot about animals and do their best to enforce it aggressively. But then there are some who are maybe more on the pro-business side or, you know, have some more cozy relationships with some of these facilities. And they are actually interpreting it sort of much more conservatively, I guess. I remember for a story I did, I interviewed someone who said that there was a zoo and an animal had escaped because they had left the door open. And the inspector she was working with was like, oh, well, there's no rule in the Animal Welfare Act specifically against leaving the door open. So they couldn't cite it. She was like, are you kidding me?
Like you said, there are some good guys who are on the animal side in the USDA.
Right.
It's just like so many other things, I think, in how we deal in this country and globally with animals. The systems are so messed up that it's so hard to fix anything on an individual level or case level. It's a big thing to try to change and fix. The USDA's job is to go in and inspect facilities where animals are on display or they're in labs, et cetera. And then when they are doing things badly or poorly or they're breaking the Animal Welfare Act, they get citations and eventually they get fines. Is that it?
Yeah. So the USDA can cite you, they can fine you, they can also revoke or temporarily suspend your license, which would mean you can't deal in animals anymore. That's pretty much all the options available to them.
The reason I'm bringing this up is because you wrote a story called Toothless and Paltry, Critics Slam USDA's Fines for Animal Welfare Violations. And I read that story. Eric actually sent me a lot of your stories. But this one really got me because it is stunning what it takes to get a fine. And these are like billions and billions of dollar corporations. And they're getting like $3,000 fines, $10,000 fines.
I think that some of the most egregious are these big labs that bring in billions in revenue every year. And then they're fined, you know, $5,000. So I started on this story because Eric sort of alerted me to it, but also I looked on the USDA's website and they list all their enforcement actions. And I was looking at some of their fines and I just noticed that the vast majority of them were like less than $10,000, which, you know, that might be a big penalty to a roadside zoo that doesn't have a lot of resources, but like a lot of the places that were being fined were like LabCorp, which is like a big lab that, you know, earns a lot of revenue every year, billions in revenue. So I just kind of started poking around to see if this was a pattern, and it really is. The lead example at the top of my story is Colorado State University, which had some bats die. They have like a shade cloth up on the windows and they got stuck in them. And then a few died. And then 2 years later, the USDA found more, another one that was dead in the same manner. And they fined them for a paltry amount. And then within a month, 20 more had died in the same exact way. And so it's kind of like, is Colorado State University learning its lesson? Probably not.
No. And they fine them like $5,000 or something ridiculous.
Yeah, $5,800.
Okay. In that same story, you talked to Delcy Winders, who's been on the show. I love her.
Yes, she's
and to explain to me, because she does a thing where in your story where she says what the fines should be. If the fines were actually legit and like a $2,000 fine should actually be something like a $200,000 fine. Will you explain how she comes up with that, where those numbers come from?
She looks at the maximum possible fine the USDA could issue for each violation and for each animal affected and for like the number of days they were affected. So okay. I think it was about 12,000. Yeah, it's about $12,771 per day. And so she would just take that fine and say like 20 animals were affected. So you multiply it by 20 and it'd say they were, you know, held in cages in their own feces for 2 days. Then you can multiply that by two. And a lot of times these fines ended up being like $200,000, $300,000, but the amount they were actually fined was $2,500, $3,000, you know? And so it's like the USDA is not giving even close to the maximum possible fine. And you might not want to give a $200,000 fine to like a roadside zoo that could never pay that. But somewhere like LabCorp, absolutely, you should be giving them a $200,000 fine because they can pay it and they won't change their ways unless they have to.
So no one has any real incentive to change.
No, definitely not.
Roadside zoos are also policed, quote unquote, by the USDA.
Right.
We have around, I don't know, 3,000, is that roadside zoos? They're notoriously pretty horrible for animals. How does that work? Because they don't get shut down very often.
I did a story on how the USDA has sort of maybe too cozy relationship with a lot of these facilities, because the USDA in several, you know, official documents they've issued, they refer to these businesses as their customers. And so, I mean, really, the U.S. public should be their customers. Like, we are, you know, our taxpayer dollars are funding them, and they're supposed to be there to enforce the Animal Welfare Act, which American people support. But really, they see the roadside zoo owners as their customers. And they, so they like feel the need to sort of work with them. So if they're, instead of like fining them or revoking their license when they see animal welfare problems, they are in some cases more likely to be like, oh, will you please fix that? You know, and then they don't, and then they let them off the hook. So I think that's sort of how the cruelty persists, I guess.
You've spoken with a lot of former USDA employees who were actually pretty remorseful about a lot of the goings on. Will you talk about that?
Things have always been bad, but I think they've gotten worse in recent years, but in terms of that cozy relationship and it being more like treating the roadside zoo owners like their customers. In 2021, I spoke to a bunch of former USDA inspectors who were just very critical of the way things are there. You know, I spoke to one woman who left within a year because she just was so disgusted with how things happened there. Oh, you know, she talked about visiting a dog breeder, you know, a puppy mill, and coming up with a whole list of citations. And her sort of senior inspector she was in working with was like, oh no, you know, we're not going to cite that. Just give them a warning, or like a verbal warning kind of thing, and forget about it. And so she left quickly. And then I spoke to Bill Stokes, who'd been there for decades. And he was just talking about how, especially in the last few years, things have gotten just really bad. And he, yeah, was just very critical of the USDA.
During Trump, it got way worse, right?
I think it's important to emphasize that it was always bad, because this is not just like a president problem, right? It's like
the USDA has
for decades been kind of not doing their job. But under Trump, like warnings and license revocations just dipped to like an all-time low. I mean, I think there were no warnings issued in like for an entire year at one point. There was a specific person in charge of the USDA. Her name was Bernadette Juarez. And I think she was like, do not issue citations. Oh, I mean, she didn't quite say that, but it was like, that was the environment they felt that a lot of these former inspectors were describing. It was just like, they felt like if they issued any kind of punishment, you know, to these facilities, that they would be themselves reprimanded.
I thought because of all the Tiger King stuff, all those guys getting taken down and losing their licenses. I mean, that was more from the Tiger King than from the USDA for sure. But
definitely.
I thought maybe that would have like somehow like sparked something that like things need to change a little bit, but no.
Not really among the USDA. I think a lot of people who visit zoos are hopefully more aware of some of the problems now, because, you know, they know that Tiger, you know, that Joe Exotic is behind some of these places, like, or Joe Exotic like folks are behind these places. But I don't necessarily think anything has changed in terms of regulation.
It's really depressing. You're talking about it and people like PETA are fighting it. But yeah. This should be, I mean, it's crazy that for 60 years, how many animals have suffered massively because they don't want to be running it.
Some people have suggested that there should be an entire new agency under the government created just for the purpose of animal welfare. But obviously that would take a huge amount of work and a huge push to get that actually in place. And I also think that people kind of, it's almost like the Animal Welfare Act is like a security blanket because it's like, oh, we have the Animal Welfare Act to protect the animals. Like they're okay. And they don't realize that it's actually not very strong and that it's not being very aggressively enforced.
You wrote a really powerful piece that really describes what is wrong with all of this.
Oh,
the one about the elephants at the Comerford Zoo. Will you tell the story of those elephants? And like, this is where like we failed them as taxpayers, as the USDA. Like there were so many opportunities to help these elephants and no one did.
That was an instance where the Comerford Zoo, which is like a traveling circus type roadside zoo, I guess, they had three elephants named Karen, Beulah, and Minnie. And Karen and Beulah both died. One of them actually died during a performance. She just collapsed, or during a circus event, she just collapsed. And I think she had uterine infection and it got into her blood and then she just collapsed at this event. And then the other one had kidney failure. But it turns out that looking at USDA records and some of their medical records, like they had been sick for a really long time and the zoo knew about it and the USDA knew about it and no one stopped them from performing. And so their third elephant, Minnie, they still own her and she's still theoretically on their property, but they have not used her in any performances since the backlash they've gotten from the other two elephants, and nobody really knows what's going on with her. But it's just really crazy to think that the USDA could have known for so long that they were sick and suffering and being forced to perform while they were sick, and then until they really just gave out.
And they did nothing. I think another hopeful part of this is like even you writing the story on these elephants and other press that these elephants have gotten because it was so just horrible, is that it's making people aware, I hope, that, hey, maybe it's not such a good idea to go to these roadside zoo traveling circuses. Like these are torture for animals.
Right. Something that gives me hope when I'm writing these stories is like how the public reacts. And I think when they know about things like Karen and Beulah collapsing, you know, from being overworked basically and sick, that is upsetting to them and they don't want to support things like this. And I think almost it's like you can put the power in the hands of the people and they can use their money or not use their money to support like roadside zoos. You know, they don't want to go to like zoos that make them uncomfortable because they can see animals are clearly suffering. That's sort of, you know, to stop going to these places.
If we would stop going to this stuff, if we would stop participating in it, then you wouldn't have to worry about the USDA. But like we do, unfortunately. And Minnie, no one's seen Minnie. Is there some mysterious thing happening with her?
Since the other two have died, she hasn't been in any performances. And I know the Comerford Zoo has sort of like an elephant pasture and on private property, and it's sort of presumed that she's there, but no one has seen her since, I think, 2019.
She might actually be dead, too.
She might, yeah. I don't think that they have to notify anyone that she's dead. I mean, the USDA should know, but they're not necessarily going to share that either.
Pretty much everything you work on is pretty sad. Has it changed your faith in humanity? Has it changed your worldview?
It's definitely changed the way I think about animals because I was always an animal lover, but I didn't really think that hard about the way we treat animals in society in terms of like, I would go to a zoo and I would assume that everyone there is acting in the best interests of the animals because It's like, I love animals. They must love animals too. But it's actually not true. It's just, you know, so like I went to a roadside zoo for a story a little over a year ago in Virginia, the Natural Bridge Zoo. And it's just sad to see some of the animals because like they have this elephant there named Asha and she's been there for like more than 30 years now all by herself. And it's like, that's, I mean, you know, maybe before I started this job, I would think like, oh, I'm sure they're taking good care of her. But now it's sort of like looking into these things, I know that they're not, you know, like they're like, she's been alone and there's been sort of undercover investigations. Like the Humane Society did an undercover investigation and they found them saying some very troubling things about her care. And she has this little elephant barn in the winter that I don't think is heated. And I mean, so it's like, I guess I have sort of a more critical eye when it comes to animal stuff now that I have this job. Yeah. And thinking about, I think I just assumed that everyone else was looking out for the animals before I had this job. And now I know that they're not, and we need to be on it more.
Because very few people, and most people, the huge majority of people are just like you were before this. Oh, they have an elephant. You know, like,
yeah.
Oh, you must be so happy because nothing's asking you to think about it.
Right.
And
yeah.
And then when you start opening the curtains and seeing what's really happening.
Yes.
And I found it, I think, in more than one of your articles in interviewing or talking to roadside zoo owners, they say, oh, no, we treat them like family.
Yes.
And one thing I've realized, like anytime an animal's being exploited or they're making money for somebody, that is always the line. Oh, no, we treat them like our family. They're our family.
It's so true. I've heard that a lot. Would you really, you know, keep grandma out in a stable by herself the whole winter?
When these articles have been released, especially the ones that really focus on the USDA, what kind of response are you getting from readers? Are they surprised?
I think that people are surprised because I think, you know, like I said, people think of the Animal Welfare Act and it sort of reassures them, you know, they're like, oh, someone's taking care of it. You know, when you lift the curtain and show, actually, they're not really taking care of it, then people are angry. I think that people care and they are surprised and they want to know how they can do better.
And I want to talk about one more thing, which is completely unrelated because I'm so glad you did a story on this. The coconut monkeys in Thailand.
Oh yeah.
it is like, it almost sounds like it's a joke, but one thing you really look into it, it's absolutely horrific. What's happening to these monkeys.
PETA did this investigation and found that a lot of coconut milk companies are using monkey labor, which like you said, sounds like a joke, but it's like these coconut farmers literally have monkeys like in cages on their farms. And then they train them to climb up and twist the coconuts off. And then they, you know, create their products from that. But yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, I got a lot of pushback on like, oh, well, you know, don't they like climbing trees? Or, and it's like, well, it's not so much about the tree climbing as the treatment they receive when they're not, which is like they're in cages, they're trained using sort of brutal methods and they're often held alone and they're very social creatures. So it's kind of like, it's a brutal life for them.
And they probably don't like going up a tree and coming back down.
I mean, unpaid labor, right?
Just when you think like you can't hear about something like even more horrible and ridiculous and that we've come up with to torture an animal, you hear something like monkey labor. And a lot of that coconut milk sold here.
Yeah. Well, I think that was a big part of the story too, was like, a lot of people who drink coconut milk are drinking it because they're trying to avoid animal exploitation. And, you know, it, like they don't want to, they're vegan or they don't want to, you know, participate in abusing agriculture or animals in the U.S. And it's like, oh no, here it's happening again.
Wow.
I mean, not to be, I know you said it's depressing and it is kind of depressing. I definitely think a lot more about everything I use now because it's like, was a forest deforested to get my lotion products, you know? I mean, and like animals killed and that. I mean, it's just, it makes you kind of question everything you buy and use.
That's craziness. Rachel, thank you so much. To learn more about Rachel and to read her articles, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. If you have a spare moment and could do us a favor, please subscribe, rate, review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you would like to support the podcast, we'd greatly appreciate it. Go to our website, speciesunite.com, and click donate. I would like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knudsen, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, and Anna Kallner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.